We still have quite a few people joining us, so we'll give it another minute or so and then we'll get started.
Sandy, I'm trying this meeting totally from my phone, so if it gets looking crazy, let me know.
You're looking good so far.
Oh, thanks. I can see you guys and hear everything.
And just testing, this is Laura. Are you able to hear me? Okay, cool.
Yep, I can hear you. Sorry. Yeah. I think we have a quorum, and it's 5:31, so we'll go ahead and start our Public Health Advisory Council meeting for October 22nd. And I want to welcome everybody on this nice fall day. I love seeing the sunshine and the fall colors, even if it is a little chilly outside. So enjoy every minute we can get because I think the rain is coming. So anyway, welcome everybody. And we're going to get started with our roll call. And as always, we have a little icebreaker for tonight. And tonight's icebreaker is, what is your favorite Halloween costume that you or your family member has worn? What is a favorite Halloween costume that you or one of your family members has worn over? Doesn't have to be recently, it can be years ago if you want it to be. So, all right, we'll get started with Ashley.
Well, my family doesn't necessarily dress up that often, but one of my nieces, like a couple years ago, wore like a jasmine costume. It was really cute. She looked really pretty.
That's cute. Great, thank you. Brianne Scarlett Fisher.
Hi, yes.
Hi.
I would say that my favoritest costume would have been the year that my husband went as the dude. He had a white Russian in his hand and a bathrobe. It looked pretty cool.
Thank you. Emma Bloom.
It must be my son. We dressed up as Mike Wazowski from Monsters, Inc., the big monster from Monsters, Inc. He was handheld, so.
Emily Estes. Oh, I know she has a cute one too. She's not on yet, so we'll come back to her. Franklin Johnson. I don't see Franklin here. Somebody say something. Assistant Chief Buste.
Yes, I apologize if you already called me. I had to step
No, I
away.
didn't.
Okay, good. I had to step away and take a really quick phone call. My favorite costume for me, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's the most memorable. My mom made us these clown costumes many, many years ago. And every time I look at the pictures, it's one of those that belongs on one of those awkward photo websites. But it's definitely the most memorable one that I had.
Memorable works. All right, thank you. Dr. Fisher.
Hey, good evening, everybody. I was once in a long blonde wig as Lucius Malfoy, as the greeter at a fundraiser.
Right, great. Dr. Trong.
My favorite costume was a pumpkin costume my kids wore for their first Halloween. First, it was worn by my son, and then it was passed on to my daughter later on. And so that was their first trick-or-treating costume. So that's my favorite costume.
First one's always fun, that's for sure. Lori Schott.
Mine would probably also have to be most memorable. When I lived in Seattle, I borrowed one. I don't generally do get dressed up, but someone had a slug costume. And so it was a very kind of heavy duty vinyl stuff with a big long slime trail made out of Bisqueen. And I had to lay down in the back seat of the car because I couldn't sit up. And it was an adventure. So.
It's maybe Northwest. All right, I'm going to come back. I see Emily has joined us. I'll come back to Emily.
Hi. Favorite Halloween costume? Was that it?
Yes, That you or a family member?
I have identical twin daughters, and one of them is Frances Almond, and so I dressed her up as a jar of almond butter with a Costco label on it, and her sister as a jam jar. And I actually took them through the Costco line, and they scanned because I had like made the label bigger. She was Frances Almond butter.
Can you share a picture at the end? That sounds so cute.
I
They're cute. She shared a picture with us the other day, and they're very cute. All right, Mark Collier. I don't see him. Hey, Marla.
My favorite one was when we had our first daughter, and she got to be right around two, a little bit more than two. It was her first Halloween, and I made a little kitty cat outfit for her with a little headgear and the little ears sticking up, and it was all dark, furry, fuzzy, cuddly stuff. Had a long tail, and I thought she was just adorable. And then got to do it all over again 4 years later with her sister. And so it was fun to be able to relive that costume again with the new child, and it was one of my favorite Halloweens ever.
Great. Thanks, Arla. Michael Watkins.
Well, I don't know. Good evening. I don't know if I have a favorite one, but every Halloween season, my family, my daughter and her family and grandkids all go to Disney and to the Oogie Boogie Bash. And this year she dressed up like Winnie the Pooh, and she met some folks that were on a quest to take pictures with 100 different Winnie the Poohs that night. And so she's got some pictures of all these Winnie the Poohs together.
Multiple Winnie the Poohs. All right, thanks, Michael. Nissa Buchanan. I don't see her. Paul Childers. You're on mute, Paul.
Now, can
There
you
you go.
now? Can you
We
hear me
can.
now?
Yes, we can.
Good, good. I still have this costume. It's a complete Freddy Krueger outfit, complete with the whole head mask, the hat, the pants, and the one claw and one hand. What I used to do, I would set a chair out by my front porch. And I would kind of just sit in that chair and kind of slump over a little bit. The kids would come running up to say trick or treat. And the minute they saw me, they'd stop and they'd say, "He's real." And the other kid would say, "No, he's not. See, he's just a dummy." And so they would be going back and forth, but they wouldn't move. And then they would get closer and closer, and when they got right up on me, I would stand up, and it was a kind of an interesting Halloween. Yeah,
That's kind of fun.
it was always, it was always so funny because they would stop dead in their tracks, and they'd say, "He's not real." "Yes, he is." "No, he's not." So anyway, that's I still have that, but it's been a couple of years since I've worn it.
Sounds fun. Thanks, Paul. Rob Ferrier.
There was a TV show on a few years back called The Big Bang Theory, and there was a couple of characters on that show. One was named Sheldon Cooper, and the other was named Amy Farrah Fowler. So my wife dressed up as Amy, and I dressed up as Sheldon, and we went to a party. It was kind of fun.
That sounds fun. All right. Mine's next. We don't usually dress up, but we were on a trip and decide on Halloween. And so I dressed up as a witch and I made my face all green and I had a big nose and the striped stockings and everything. And I was traveling with some family members, some my sister-in-law and brother-in-law and so on. And so I met them in the dining room and I walked right up to them and they were so scared and they didn't know who I was. And they were like, get away, you know? And then I said something and they realized who I was, but it scared them, and they didn't know what stranger was walking up and kind of getting in their bubble because this ugly old witch with this big nose came walking up to them. So that was really fun. Scott Johnson.
The only thing I remember about wearing Halloween costumes was those plastic masks that had like no breathing hole, really crappy eye holes, and being upset when my mom said, lift up the mask so you stop walking into things. So I don't know if that counts as favorite, but that's my memory of wearing Halloween costumes.
Well, that's a memory and that works. All right, Tracy Fernandez.
Yes, I don't remember my favorite. I remember my least favorite because someone picked it for me. I was Elvira.
Why?
Yeah. And I had the wig and everything, and I was like, I don't want to wear this. But so that was my least favorite.
Okay, that works. Thanks. Tyler.
One I kind of remember the most from most recently was a few years ago, I dressed up as Napoleon Dynamite from the movie Napoleon Dynamite, so that was fun.
Great, thanks. Counselor Marshall.
So my favorite is my grandson's costume this year. He's 7 years old with red hair, and he's going as Dwight Schrute from The Office. He looks pretty authentic.
Great. Dr. Melnick.
So before I tell you about my Halloween costume, I got to admit that I have the dude sweater. So if everybody knows what the dude sweater looks like, so the dude abides. My favorite, I think, was, I'm going to date myself here. I was the Cowardly Lion from The Wizard of Oz, and I can smile like Bert Lahr, so maybe that's why it worked.
Andrea, is she here tonight? I think
She's
so.
going to be a little bit late.
Okay. Dana? I don't see her either.
Dana's she's in Europe on vacation.
Well, then she's not here, is she? She's having fun. Jerry Preston. See him.
Jerry
He's
is
not going to
also
be
out
here tonight
tonight.
either.
Go ahead, yeah.
I see Jeff, so let's see what his costume is.
I'm going to go with something my daughter actually made last year. She was 14 and she took a dinosaur mask and putty and actually built a werewolf mask with ears, the whole nine yards. It looked professional. It was amazing. And she, it was just, it was, I was blown away. I could never have done that at her age. There's zero chance.
Talented girl. Roxanne.
I am cracking up, I swear. I mean, I'm like, as soon as was it Tyler, was it you that said the Napoleon Dynamite? I'm thinking, though, for Pedro, my favorite movie is one of my favorite movies is Napoleon Dynamite. So that cracked me up. But I do think that I was thinking back, and my dad was an electrician by trade, and so we were a poor, struggling family with nothing but moving boxes and some aluminum foil. So he actually put together this really awesome costume with boxes and aluminum foil, and I was a robot. And then he was able to wire up Christmas lights to it, and I could actually control the lights and talk to people with lights while I was walking up the street. The challenge was there was no way to see out of it, out of this costume. So my mom had to, like direct me, there's a curb, there's a kid in front of you, don't trip, that sort of a thing. So that was really, really, really fun. And you can do a lot with aluminum foil and some duct tape, actually, by the way.
Great. Guadalupe.
There, so I'm trying to get myself on mute. Let's see. My fiance dresses up as Michael Myers. It's some of my favorite movies. So yeah, I'd say that's my favorite costume. And he sits outside too and kind of waits for kids to. They're all like, "Is it real?" And then he'll just move a little bit, but they'll kind of get a good scare. And then some of them laugh. There was a last year. Like a 2-year-old that was like, "I want to see the scary movie man," and he was dressed as a little police guy, and he's like, "I want to go inside to see the scary movie man." So it was adorable.
Memorable to the kids too. Mallory.
I think my favorite costume was when my son was 9 months old and we dressed him up as a yard gnome.
Cute. All right, did I get everyone? I think I did.
It looks like we have someone, I don't know who it is, but it looks like it might be a phone, Pixel 6. Is that anyone? Anyone from the public, maybe?
I see that. I don't hear them.
Mallory, it's Marla. I am on my phone. But I've because I don't I'm not able to use my computer here. But I don't think it would be called Pixel 6. I don't know.
Okay.
Is it
That
an
well,
Android phone or is it a
it's an iPhone. iPhone.
Pixel 6 is an Android, so
Oh.
we should probably know who Pixel 6 is, but if it is a member of the public, it would be nice if they were to say so. Whoever Pixel 6 is, they just muted themselves.
It might be me, Mark Collier.
Oh, okay.
Thank
Yep,
you,
that's
Mark.
you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Do you have a favorite costume you want to share with us?
Well, I was invited to a ha Halloween party at the last minute and didn't know what I want to do for a costume. So I basically went, put my motorcycle leathers on and went as a biker.
Great. That's a good last minute costume. All right. Well, thanks everybody. That was kind of a fun little exercise and hear about the fun costumes that everyone has been or had in a family. So great responses. Thank you. I think the next thing is to review and approve our minutes from our September 24th meeting. And as always, Mallory sent those out shortly after our last meeting. And hopefully, all of you had a chance to look over those. Does anybody have any additions or changes to those minutes? I don't hear of any.
Nope.
Okay, so I guess we can move to approve the minutes from the September 24th meeting. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Anybody opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. All right, and I don't think we have anyone from the public, but do you have anybody, Mallory?
Nope, no members from the public.
All righty, great. Then we'll move on to Dr. Melnick and the health officer update.
Good evening, everybody. I'm going to just give a brief update on where we are in terms of respiratory illness. We've begun, we're now, as Sandy was mentioning, as we get into the fall weather, while we're enjoying that weather, we're also beginning to enter respiratory illness season. So, and that means we'll be seeing more cases of RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, as well as influenza. And we still have COVID-19 circulating. But COVID-19 is a respiratory illness, but it doesn't follow the seasonal pattern like RSV and influenza. So we monitor COVID-19 activity throughout the year, but now that we're in the respiratory season, we'll resume our routine monitoring of influenza and RSV. And if you go to our website, we're putting this on our social media, but if you go to our website, we have a respiratory illness data webpage We post the updates on Thursdays, and we share the data on emergency department visits and hospitalizations due to these respiratory virus illnesses. And we're also monitoring influenza and COVID-19 deaths, and these we'll be reporting on monthly on our website and social media. RSV deaths are not required to be reported. They're not notifiable like those others, so we're not including those in our updates. We've also, on our website, we have the respiratory illness dashboards from the State Department of Health, as well as links to statewide data on virus activity and vaccination rates. And also, our infectious disease team is collecting lab results from local healthcare providers to see what's happening around influenza test positivity. And we'll be sending updates to healthcare providers as well. I just want to mention it's not too late to get the influenza vaccine if you haven't already gotten it. And hopefully people are updated on their COVID-19 vaccines as well. So far, influenza and RSV activity has been very low and is not really contributing to emergency department visits or hospitalizations. Emergency department visits and hospitalizations to COVID-19 increased slowly throughout the summer and across the state. And over the last month, the percentages have fluctuated locally. So the most recent week of data, October 6th to 12th, hospitalizations due to COVID-19 decreased to 1.7%, which is a bit lower than this time last year. And likewise, the emergency department visits, 1.3% of them were due to COVID, and that's slightly lower than same time last year. We're also, you might have read about this in the Columbian, we're also seeing a significant increase in pertussis or whooping cough. And most of the cases are among people who are not vaccinated. So through September, we had 288 cases of pertussis. That's more in the last 6 years combined. We had 14 in 2023. And thought we were doing a little bit better because over the summer, we were having 60 cases a month. And then in September, it dropped to 50. But I got to tell you, so far in October, we've had 54 cases. So I will suspect October will be over 60. So we've had 342 cases of pertussis in Clark County this year. We are leading the state. We're ahead of King County, for example, and pertussis is up all across the state. But we're the champions here. I got to tell you that as of the 288 cases we had at the end of September, nearly two-thirds had never, ever received a pertussis vaccine. And the pertussis vaccine is a vaccine that you get multiple times when you're a child and at least every 10 years as an adult. And where 64% of the cases, I'm going to repeat that again, are in people who have never even had one dose. And if you add the people who are under vaccinated, who've had more than zero, but less than what they should be having, 67% of the cases are in people who are susceptible, who are under immunized. There's been one hospitalization and no deaths. So the bottom line is, the best way to prevent getting pertussis and spreading it to others, it's the other thing that drives me up, crazy and keeps me up about whooping cough, is the first 2 weeks of illness, you only have mild cold symptoms, yet the whoop hasn't started yet, but you're contagious during the first 2 weeks. And if you've never been, there's no way to know that you have pertussis. So the best way to prevent this, including transmission, is to get vaccinated. It's recommended for all babies, children, preteens, and pregnant women. And adults who've never received a Tdap should get one. And, you could still get whooping cough if you've got vaccinated, but the disease is much less likely to be severe, and the vaccine does prevent transmission and getting it in the first place. So that's all I got for an update. Sorry for going on so long. And Councillor Marshall has a question.
Yes, thank you. It's alarming to hear the cases keep going up. Is there any special efforts that are underway as far as public awareness or interacting with the schools or any efforts underway to raise awareness and increase the vaccine level?
Yeah, great question, Council Marshall. We've put out our we're active on social media around this, and we put out a number of postings on social media. I believe Roxanne and Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, I think we've issued a up news release in the past. That's how we got into the news, and it's been in the Columbian a lot. It's been in the news, so, and we've done interviews, so, but yeah, we had issued a news release early on. I'm concerned now that everybody's going back to school, and kids are going to be congregating with each other more, and especially in school, the schools. You can get on the state website and the immunization website, and you can actually look at by county, and you can look at by school building what the immunization rates are. And there are some school buildings in Clark County where the immunization rates are really pretty low. But we've gotten information out through the press, press release, interviews, social media. So we'll continue to do that.
We
Roxanne, were you going
also,
to say
yeah, no,
something?
I was just going to add too, I believe we did provider advisories directly to the providers as well, correct, Ellen?
Yeah, I believe so.
Could you work through ESD 112 or notices going home with kids in elementary school?
I don't know what ES, I don't know if ESD 112 had done. We could certainly speak with them about that.
Thanks.
I was cheery for everybody. I apologize.
Thanks for that update. That's always interesting to know where we stand. And we like to be number one, but I'm not sure in this case we want to be number one. That's for sure.
Yeah,
All
I
right.
think our vaccination, I mean, you might recall we had a measles outbreak at the beginning of the year. I'm really concerned about vaccine preventable illness.
All right. Would you like to introduce Guadalupe, who's going to do our presentation on infectious disease?
Hello,
I'm just
everyone.
trying to unmute myself there. I apologize. Yeah, I'm delighted to introduce Guadalupe Perez, who's our program manager in our infection prevention program. And she's going to give you a robust presentation of the infection prevention pilot project that she and her team have been leading with adult family homes. And she'll describe the whole thing to you. So I won't go, I'll stop there and let her give her presentation.
Thank you, Alan. And then do we have the slides or should I screen share?
Valerie's on it.
All right. I'll go ahead and begin. Hello, everyone. My name is Guadalupe Perez. I'm the Infection Prevention Program Manager here at Clark. And as Alan said, I'll be providing an overview of the Adult Family Home Epidemic Preparedness tool that this program helped create. Next slide. So, in response to an identified need for epidemic preparedness in the adult family homes statewide, Clark County Public Health and Washington State Department of Health teamed up to create this epidemic preparedness tool to assist adult family home providers to become better prepared for epidemics. The tool aims to increase health equity in our adult family home community and incorporated learnings from the COVID-19 pandemic and feedback from our providers as well. Adult family homes are typically smaller. They're home-like settings that provide care to up to six residents. They often exist within normal residential neighborhoods, and residents tend to be more frail and require a higher level of care than those in assisted living facilities. Now, I'd like to just provide a brief overview of pandemics versus epidemics, since we'll be talking about epidemics quite a bit. So, pandemics are large, widespread epidemics that
that spread across multiple countries and continents. They're characterized by exponential growth of an increased disease that is international or out of control. And we're most familiar with the COVID-19 pandemic. And while an epidemic is characterized by an unexpected increase in the number of disease cases in a specific area, so such as like measles or polio, West Nile virus, epidemics can happen anytime, anywhere, and often occur without warning. They will occur in the future, and it's not always clear when they will happen, so preparing for them is critical. Next slide. During the COVID-19 pandemic, there were concerns of inequity for adult family homes that were caused by the adult family homes being left out of the governor's proclamation at the beginning of the pandemic. This led to the identification of areas for improvement. Identified needs included personal protection equipment, PPE, testing supplies, and vaccinations, some noted here on the slide. By leveraging the relationships with Department of Health, Washington Department of Health, and the Adult Family Home Council, Clark County Public Health was able to attend strategic meetings to pursue continued advocacy for adult family homes support and health equity. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Clark County Public Health identified resources to provide much needed support for these adult family homes by establishing PPE push packs, obtaining testing kits, and bringing COVID-19 vaccinations to residents and staff. Next slide. In the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, Clark County had the most adult family homes per capita in the state of Washington. The number of adult family homes in 2020 grew by 12%, so from 367 to 411. This number has continued to grow. To date, Clark County has 482 adult family homes. With the increased number of adult family homes, it is crucial to identify and address residents' needs in this setting. Next slide. Critical early interventions and actions that Clark County Public Health took to address these identified needs included during the COVID-19 pandemic, included those PPE push packs, securing PPE for adult family homes from our healthcare partners to ensure adequate response for immediate outbreaks, inviting the adult family home owners to the COVID-19 outbreak situational weekly meeting updates, and partnering with healthcare providers to advocate for adult family homes to better obtain access, such as like visiting nurses, testing, and staffing, as well as provision of COVID-19 vaccines, and then also partnering with the Washington Department of Health to provide infection control assessment and response assessments in these settings. These critical early interventions in Clark County Public Health initiated were the foundation for this project, and with the help of Department of Health, helped foster these solid partnerships and ensure that adult family homes could initiate outbreak control measures immediately to limit transmission. The most beneficial intervention that was developed was the adult family home PPE push packs. Next slide. And here are a couple photos of the adult family home PPE push packs. Contents included isolation gowns, face shields, surgical mask, and gloves. And they were provided to adult family homes with an active outbreak to provide, just PPE when they most need it, and provide outbreak response guidance. Next slide. In January of 2023, as the pandemic continued, our focus transitioned from immediate interventions toward like long-term care solutions. So the pilot project was initiated in collaboration with our Washington Department of Health partners and the Adult Family Home Council. The goal was to better understand adult family home infection prevention needs, increase access to epidemic preparedness planning, and establish sustainable communication between the adult family homes and local health departments for continued emergency preparedness. Next slide. And in January of 2023, as I mentioned, so CCPH and DOH developed a project plan. Following month in February, the Adult Family Home Council joined the project. And in March, Adult Family Home Council, the Vancouver chapter, invited Clark County Public Health and Department of Health to present on epidemic preparedness. During this meeting, there was a high level of engagement from the adult family home owners. Feedback obtained from the adult family home owners included the desire for more information on fit testing. Interactive trainings were reported to be useful and helpful. And interest in learning more about epidemic preparedness was also voiced. In April of 2023, the second Adult Family Home Vancouver chapter meeting was held. There, a Department of Health occupational health nurse presented on N95 fit testing. Clark County Public Health and DOH nurse as well also recruited 11 interested adult family home owners for this pilot project. And then in-person engagement continued to remain high. Adult family home owners reported that they found the fit testing education valuable as well. Next slide. In July of 2023, Clark County Public Health and Department of Health developed a survey to find out more about adult family home owners' interests related to infection prevention. The survey was sent out to all adult family homes in Clark County. Though the response rate was low, we still gained valuable information. At the Adult Family Home Council, the fall conference, Department of Health continued to seek in-person engagement, positive feedback, and questions as well. And in February, from September 2023 to November of 2023, the development of the Adult Family Home tool began, and the focus was to make the tool easily to read and usable. Next slide. And information gathered from the adult in-person meetings and the survey that was sent out to the adult family home owners helped shape the tool. July's survey that was sent out to 380 licensed adult family homes with a low response rate of 24 respondents. The survey had 7 questions, and the survey aimed to learn more about the trainings that that the adult family home owners were interested in, and then what trainings that they have received and their preferred learning styles. And on the slide here, we have the questions that were asked. And next slide. The most notable feedback from the survey was question 1, the infection prevention topics that you would like to learn more information about. So respondents desired more training on the epidemic preparedness, and the topic that they identified as having received the least amount of training was also epidemic preparedness and outbreak management. This verified that Clark County Public Health was on target with the adult family home owners' interest in epidemic preparedness and education. And here we have the 2 slides, the respondents and the stars here kind of note epidemic preparedness where it lies on that graph. Next slide. In December of 2023, Clark County Public Health led an educational webinar on the epidemic preparedness tool. Engagement and turnout was low than the previous in-person meetings as a result of the low turnout in December's webinar. In January, the tool was sent out along with a survey to all adult family homes in Clark County to assess the tool's functionality and obtain additional feedback. Following in February of 2024, the feedback from the adult family home owners was received, and the survey was updated to incorporate that feedback. Next slide. Moving on to March of 2024 this year, the tool was sent out to our external partners for review. Feedback was obtained from residential care services, as well as Department of Health leadership. And it was important to us to ensure that community partners' expertise was incorporated and that each organization's definition of health equity was met. In May, the tool was finalized. Clark County Public Health, Department of Health, and in collaboration with the Adult Family Home Council, partnered to provide an in-person education training on the tool at the Vancouver Adult Family Home Chapter meeting. And continued education was offered through the Adult Family Home Council as well to the participants. And as of September, the tool is now available on our Clark County Long-Term Care Facility webpage, and the tool is also available on the Department of Health webpage, available for and on that website, it's available for all adult family homes across the state to access and use. And I have the web pages here as well. Okay. So key learning. So during this project, a few lessons learned were that building trusting relationship takes time. In-person presentations and training hold the most engagement, and offering continuing education was key for the online education and trainings as well. And also to avoid educational sessions during the holiday seasons as well. Next slide. And now I'm going to provide a brief overview of the tool and take a look at it. Next slide. On the first here, we have the epidemic preparedness tool. It's a fillable document. The first page here includes instructions and provides a section for the partners to kind of target the top three priorities they wish to address. And it is a fillable document. They can put their logo on here as well. Next slide. The tool has four main sections of the epidemic assessment, four main sections for epidemic assessment and planning. Step one here allows providers to assess and address their operational processes for obtaining supplies such as PPE, also staffing, and planning for potential interruptions in the supply chain. And then step two here focuses on procedures for residents and employee health and safety, such as procedures on tracking illnesses in the home and procedures for equipment and supplies as well. Next slide. And step three focuses on establishing communication methods during communication methods for residents, their families, and staff, as well as external partners such as hospitals, pharmacies, Clark County Public Health, and other licensing agencies during an epidemic response. And step four here focuses on staff education and training on infection prevention practices, cleaning and disinfection, and additional safe practices. Next slide. The tool also includes some appendices. So Appendix A is a emergency contact list that provides us a space for adult family homeowners to list any contacts, have a quick reference, and as well as a space for vendors on Appendix B. They can add their vendors and contact information. And Appendix C incorporates embedded web pages for resources for the adult family homeowners as well. Next slide. And Appendix D, in response, an epidemic response drill was added for the adult family homeowners to practice drills to improve their response plans. This was an addition based on some of the feedback that was received from the surveys. Next slide. And I also like to thank our partners, because without them, this would not be possible. So our Clark County Public Health team, our Department of Health HAI team, and John Fittaker, Karen Cordero, and the Adult Family Home Council staff, everyone with the Adult Family Home Council Vancouver chapter, our partners at Peace Health Southwest, and residential care services as well with department, with DSHS. Without them, as I mentioned, this tool would not be possible. Thank you. Next slide. Thank you, everyone. Is there any questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
Thanks. Was there any targeted information, educational information to family members? Because I know my mother was in one of these facilities, and the people's homes get modified to accommodate the residents. And so it can be tight quarters, and there's family members coming in and out all the time. So was there any information that was provided to those folks that could help?
Just to repeat the question, to make sure I understood. So was there feedback provided from the family and in the adult family home in the creation of this tool?
No, I was just wondering if there was educational materials targeted to family members who are visiting their loved ones in these facilities?
Yeah, so we do have an abundance of resources for family education available on our webpage. And some of the resource links also link to family and patient education for adult family homes as well.
Within, I just wondered if there was physical, and I mean, it's one thing to tell somebody there's a website you can go look, but if there's like handouts that could be provided to family members, I just think it makes it easier.
Oh, I understand. As they mentioned, there's some handouts within those resources, but as far as like, was anything created and handed out to the families and for this tool? No.
Thanks.
Any additional questions?
Thank you, Guadalupe. That was a really interesting presentation, and it's nice to have something like that be targeted to that group. It does look like we do have one more question.
Yeah, Guadalupe, it's Bree. So this tool is for the owner of the adult family care home. Yes. So, okay. That's what I got.
Yes, that is correct. It's for them to evaluate their epidemic preparedness processes and improve on their processes.
Cool.
Any other last minute questions? If not, we're going to move on to Jeff, and he's going to do a budget update for us.
All right. Thank you. I've had the opportunity to meet with the county budget office, as well as the county finance manager who works for the county auditor's office to discuss trajectory and sort of strategic budgeting for public health. What I'm going to share has not been shared with staff yet, but I will be doing some presentations in staff brown bag sessions coming up. So public health has a minimum fund balance policy that sets our target fund balance at 2.5 months of operating cash and $1 million for emergency response activities. Basically, if we had to go into emergency response, funding may not be available from state or federal or local partners for a while. So anyway, that total is about $5.7 million. I'm going to share my screen. So this is, how do I move this thing now? There we go. So our fund balance, and I created this a few weeks ago. I know our fund balance has been growing quite a bit, but this goes back to 2003. Our fund balance since the beginning of COVID, really, and then with the Foundational Public Health Services, or FPHS, state revenue going from, again, around $300,000 to just under $7 million across 3 years, our fund balance has ballooned. This actually is showing end of 23. We're now over 14 million. So we have about an $8.5 million surplus fund balance. We are going to have a pretty big hit coming up towards the end of this year with a one-time payout to some staff related to a grievance ruling. We don't have the figure yet, but it's going to be substantial. So I went to, I had this meeting with the county budget office, as well as, like I said, the county finance manager, Mark Gassaway. Fund balance is typically used, not typically, best practice for fund balance is to be used on one times. It's not used for ongoing operational expenses. However, the situation we're in, we're going to have some very, very difficult budget periods coming up. What we talked about is a strategy of drawing down on our surplus fund balance over time to create a glide path into what the public health department can afford, in 2028 or 29. So we'll be it's using the fund balance as a glide path. So we won't necessarily be making all of the reductions in the 2026 budget to get us to a balanced budget, but we would be looking at, How can we use fund balance to put in place what we need to be successful longer term? It's kind of a, this is sort of like advanced budgeting and really brings in the strategic planning approach around budgeting. We've got, for example, we've got some grant revenue in our environmental public health unit that could be used elsewhere. And our environmental public health unit could also be funded through user fees, which they are for most things. So one of our strategies is going to be moving those grant funds to programs that cannot that do not generate fees, and then using fund balance to soften the blow on the impact from those fees. So we might use a substantial amount of fund balance to sort of glide past the fees. At the same time, working with the environmental public health management program managers and executive to ensure that we're doing everything as efficiently as possible. So it gives us time to actually look at that. I guess I want to take questions at this point before I go on from this. And I can't see any raised hands if someone's raising their hands.
Jeff, this is Roxanne. Quick question.
Yeah.
As far as the fund balance, you mentioned that we have an excess right now. Is the intent with this glide path to get down to what our fund balance policy states we should be at?
Yeah, that's a great question. The goal is to glide path in a deliberate manner, and also, yes, get the fund balance down to something that is more reasonable. To speak very frankly, we had a fairly large fund balance a few years ago, and this goes back farther than that. This is probably that dip in 2013 that you see on the screen. $1.9 million of our fund balance was taken from the public health fund without any conversation. That was really the rationale behind my conversation with the budget office and the county auditor's office. The county finance manager was, it was sort of a, how can we use our excess fund balance to possibly help ourselves long term? So yes, the goal is not only to have a glide path to a sustainable, model, but also to get the fund balance to a more reasonable place. Councillor Marshall, you have your hand up.
Yes, I guess I would like to get a better understanding of how those foundational public health dollars have been used, because it sounds, you know, and here's where a little information may be dangerous in my hands, but I attended the local public health board training. And I know there's certain areas that those foundational public health dollars can be used. I'm not quite sure how we've used them. And it does sound as though there was a bit of a windfall that went out throughout the state. So that's one thing that I'd like to better understand. And the way I'm hearing this is that that's part of this excess fund balance are those foundational public health dollars. So I wouldn't want to see it all used for a glide path when I guess I'm thinking it was intended for additional services. I may be misunderstanding things. So
yeah, this is where I was saying earlier, it's sort of more advanced budgeting. And the foundational public health services grant funds, those are cost reimbursable sources. So we had to spend those to get those dollars. And how this happens is we add positions through the county council in the plan to spend these funds. And then the positions take several months to actually get posted and filled. So we're finding other billable expenses that can maximize those grant funds that are already on site. So what we're doing is we're maximizing the grant revenue. We're maximizing the state dollars coming in the door. But at the same time, we're recognizing a vacancy savings from those vacant positions. And the positions that we're using to bill against FPHS, those were in our budget intended to be filled with a discretionary source that was not cost reimbursable. So we're still getting the discretionary funding, and we're maximizing the grant funding. The only other piece, FPHS is the largest reason why our fund balance has grown to where it is. COVID grant funding is also a reason. For the exact same reason, actually. We were able to bill a cost-reimbursable funding source for example, staff costs that would have otherwise been covered through overheads. Dr. Melnick's time, or other, our finance team was able to bill some of these grant funds, our grants and contracts team. We're not double-dipping, but we're still recognizing the discretionary revenue coming in the door. At the same time, we're maximizing state and federal dollars coming in as well. So this is going to stop. Our fund balance is not going to grow. If we did not intentionally draw down the fund balance, it would stop growing. We are at a point now where FPHS is no longer going to grow. We're no longer going to have vacancy savings. But back to the FPHS question you asked, Councilor Marshall, the grant, those dollars come in 19 separate buckets, 18 of which are very categorical. We've got a climate action bucket. We've got an environmental public health bucket around epidemiology. We've got a bucket around illicit substance use. We have one bucket that we call baseline FPHS, and that it can't quite be used on anything we do, but almost anything. And that source is actually budgeted to 11 programs within our agency the last time I looked. So our staffing growth is because of FPHS. It is that grant funding did allow us to add many staff. It did what it was intended to do. The issue with public health budgets is at this point now that funding source is like every other funding source, and that it's not going to grow. So as our staff costs rise, our revenue is flat. Surprise, what you paid for last week, you can no longer pay for. So it leads to deficits, budget deficits. What I used to tell our leadership team, and it's pretty much still the truth, is you can assume 5% of your labor budget in your current budget is going to be the deficit you walk into in your next budget.
Right.
And the good news for public health a little bit is the cost increases in our environmental public health division can mostly be picked up through fees if the Board of Health is willing to entertain that fee adjustment. It's just the rest of the department where we don't have any mechanism to increase revenues to cover those costs.
Okay, well, that sounds very complicated, and enough, I guess, for this evening. But I'll get another crack at this to better understand it as we go forward.
Yeah, I'm going to stop sharing my screen so I can see any hands raised. So we are still waiting for some information, some payroll data from Human Resources, and once I have that, I'll be able to work with our leadership team on a 4 to 5 year trajectory, a forecast model I can build for labor. Labor, like I said, labor is about 88% of our budget nowadays. So that's going to be the heavy driver for our budget. I think I've talked about in prior FAC meetings that our 2026 budget is going to include 2 full years of COLAs, or cost of living allowances, for our represented staff due to the timing of the current contract negotiation process. They're not done negotiating the contract that goes live in 2025. So there's no allowance for that contract in our 2025 budget. So our 2026 budget is going to pick up that as well as the 2026 COLA as well. So it's going to be 2 years of COLA. So our 2026 budget is going to be worse than usual. And then, not to be even more gloomy, but our 2027 budget is the first year when we no longer have support of ARPA or the American Rescue Plan Act which is paying for systems maintenance for our three big platforms. So that's about another $350,000 we'll hit in our 27 budget, along with the regular ongoing cost growth. So if I didn't give you guys enough sleeping aid there, let me know. I will. Any other questions? All right. I switched in my sophomore year of college, I switched from an engineering major to an accounting major. I was tired of advanced mathematics in engineering, and I took one accounting elective and said, this is so easy. I can do this without even studying. This is cake. And I wish I would have continued with engineering looking back, but I've been doing this 26 plus years, and I do kind of enjoy it still. So.
Well, you do a great job at keeping on top of things and keeping things in order. So thank you for that report, as cheery as it was.
Jeff, all right. You do actually make that interesting. I just want you to know, I have not heard other budget breakdowns that made me go, oh, yeah, okay.
Good to hear. Thank you.
There's no more questions for Jeff. Then we're going to move on to the FAC updates. And our membership committee, consists of Tyler and Michael, have been working on some bylaws updates around membership. And so they have some proposed changes that they want to go over with us, of which we will discuss tonight, and then we'll vote on them at the next meeting based on any conversation or any additional changes that would need to be made. So I'm going to turn it over to Tyler to kind of do his little presentation and share with us what they're suggesting.
Okay, thanks. Wait for Tyler to pull it up file here. Not a lot of changes. It's not significant in nature, any of it. I would say, you know, we were trying to approach it with the lens of from the membership committee. There's a couple other things that we kind of wanted to change just because it made sense. One of the things, if you look at the, you know, the first paragraph here, it says that herein we refer to the Public Health Advisory Council as the council in the document. There were several other locations in the document where it was referred to as the FAC, it was referred to as the advisory board. So we just made it so it was consistent throughout where it was referred to as the council. The first, if you want to scroll down just a little bit there, Mallory, we added a couple links with the help from Roxanne. One was a link to the Community Health Advisory Board, RCW. That was already mentioned in here. It was just basically this is providing the link to it directly. And then also a link to the Local and Regional Government Alliance, or maybe that one was already there. Let's scroll down a little bit more. So in Article 3, it talks about a little bit more. Let's scroll down a little bit more. Right in here, it talks about how each elected or each representative of the FAC gets appointed. It talks about some FAC members are directly appointed via, you know, the Board of Health, and then others are appointed or nominated by some other, nominating representative. It could be a city council. It could be some other agency that nominates them. So the Section 2 changes right there are really just clarifying that upon somebody's membership expiring, that they can be reappointed specifically directly by the Board of Health, or that they get nominated first by the representative member's constituent group. And then that's all dependent on how it's outlined in Article 3, Section 1. So it just outlines how people are reappointed, because it's not consistently the same for every member. Um,
Going down a little further, this is just moving one little, a small change there, just moving something so it was directly, more directly related to what it was. Going down further. The next major change. So this is, I guess, I think this is the way it was in common practice, but it wasn't real very clear in the document that the at-large member, it was clear that they can serve one term, but it wasn't clear that they could have the ability to run for additional terms if they wanted to. So we added this in, and as I'm sitting here reading it, I'm not sure it's exactly the way it should read, because it says the at-large member shall serve one-year term with the ability to run for additional terms. So maybe it should say the at-large member shall serve a one-year term with the ability to run for additional terms. I guess, I don't know, I could go either way, I guess. And I think this was about it, if I remember right.
Tyler, we can make that change and then just make sure that it's worded correctly before we have the final vote. So we can certainly, we'll update that based on tonight's conversation.
Okay. And then I don't know if Michael had anything to add in there as well.
I
Yeah,
think
if
you
anybody has
covered
any comments or
everything.
questions. Okay.
Does anybody have any comments or questions for Tyler or Michael? Roxanne said we'll kind of summarize these and we'll send them out with the minutes so that you know what we'll be voting on next time. And I want to thank both Tyler and Michael for working on this because it can be a little tedious going through word by word and making sure things are consistent, but I appreciate your work for sure.
Yeah, I guess are there any opinions on whether it says 1 1-year term or a 1-year term? No. Okay. All right.
Either sound okay to me, I think.
Okay. We'll just leave it if it sounds okay. Yeah.
We can, I'll tell you what, we'll update it. Tyler, we'll just run it past you one more time, make sure we're cool with it, and then we'll send it out to everybody as the final. Does that sound
Okay.
okay?
Yeah, great. Thank you.
I just want to add my appreciation for the work that you guys did on this. It seems like it might be a simple thing, but it's really not because there's a lot of details that you need to pay attention to. And so thanks for taking that on.
Well, the next thing is about nominations for officers. We're coming to the end of the year, and it's time to look at nominating and electing officers for the 2025 year. And the bylaws or the membership committee is also the nominations committee. So that puts Tyler and Michael on the nominations committee. Although saying that, it would be nice to have another member or two from the council that would like to join them to help them put a slate of officers together that we would vote on in the first meeting of the 2025 year. So start thinking about whether you'd like to nominate yourself or if there's someone on the council that you would like to nominate. Typically, we would the vice chair and the chair have alternating years so that the vice chair moves into the chair position. But because we've had some resignations this year, we'll need to elect a chair, a vice chair, and a member at large. So we'll be nominating and electing all of those. The executive committee will probably be discussing the terms there so that we can get back on the right schedule again. But nonetheless, whether the term is 1 year or 2 years at this point, we will need to elect in those three positions. So a couple of requests is one, if you'd like to help Tyler and Michael with this task of putting together a slate of officers for January or for our 2020 first 2025 meeting, you can either let us know tonight, put it in the chat, or let Mallory or Roxanne know, or myself know that you'd like to help them do that. The other is if you'd like to self-nominate for one of those positions, or if you know someone on the council that you'd like to nominate, you might check with them to see if they're okay if you nominate them for a particular position. But you can let the committee know if there's someone there you'd like to nominate. We'll probably have more of a robust conversation around this at our next meeting, but I did want to bring it up today because it's going to come around pretty quickly, seeing as I heard today it's 64 days till Christmas, so the first of the year isn't far behind that. So start thinking about who we want to nominate and elect as our officers for the 2025 year. Do we have any comments or questions or any volunteers at this point? Everybody's being quiet. All right. Well, we'll have a more robust conversation next time, and we may reach out to a couple of you if you're interested in being on the committee and working with Tyler and Michael.
Do you, just a question, sorry, Sandra, of the what it looks like time-wise or commitment-wise on that? I feel like I should
Well,
know this, and I'm sorry I don't.
no, that's fine. No, it's not being on the exec, you wouldn't know necessarily. The executive team meets once a month to plan the agenda and talk over different pieces of business for FAC, and we probably meet for about an hour once a month. And then as a chair, I usually meet with Roxanne to go over the facility agenda and any details about the agenda and who's presenting and that's about 15 or 20 minutes. And otherwise it's the meetings time. Sometimes we'll have some other, like meetings outside, but they're rare, or time that we might have to work on a letter that needs to be written to the council or to someone. So there might be some times when you would need to meet for a short time outside of that, but the majority of it is that 1 hour meeting where we do the planning for the meeting itself. Roxanne, do you have anything to add to that? Or Dr. Melnick?
No, I think that was a good summary. And we really do. I know you all are very busy, and we really try hard to be super efficient with the time. And then we do the CCPH staff does a lot of the heavy lifting as far as like putting all the agenda materials together and that sort of a thing. So we do sort of all those logistics. You don't have to worry about that on the executive team. But certainly if you have things that you would like to see on the agenda, that sort of a thing too. We certainly rely on you all as both as FAC members, but also on the executive team to kind of bring some priority items that you would like to discuss as well. So that would be the only other thing. And Sandy, I think I think our planning meetings or agenda planning meetings rarely, I mean, usually they're no more than an hour. I don't recall ever when it went over an hour. So yeah. So I think that you had a good synopsis.
Yeah, and they're very helpful in doing, like Mallory does a lot of work and Roxanne does a lot of work behind the scenes to help support the work and making sure it goes smoothly. So I'm really thankful for them and all the work that they do for sure. I guess one other thing that we're often involved in is the orientation of new members. There's an orientation time that's a couple of hours, and so usually the chair or the vice chair attends that and has a role in some of the presentation for new membership orientation. But that isn't regular. It's just when a new member comes on, or if we have two or three, we try to group them together so it's only one training. So that would be one of those rare kinds of situations where there'd be some extra time. A good question. Thank you. All right. So speaking of moving along on the membership kind of topic that we have, I kind of want to update you on membership because we've had some members' terms expire. And so Mark Collier has officially been reappointed as the Clark County Septic Contractors through September of 27. And Assistant Chief Buste's appointment as Clark County Law Enforcement Community has been official until September of 2025. And so I want to welcome them to being on the board or reappointed. And so we're glad to see that. The non-elected representative city of Vancouver, Elma Bloom, has also been reappointed as of September 2027. So we're glad to hear that she'll be returning. And so congratulations to all three of you. The Clark County Educational Community position is still open, and we posted that through October 31st, and we haven't had any applications at this point. So if we don't get any by the 31st, we will be reappointing or reannouncing that again. So if you know of anyone in the educational community that might be interested in this position, maybe have a chat with them and see if we can get some applications in that arena. We also are going to be advertising for the nurse practicing in Clark County. That position is going to be vacant in 2025, and that position's been posted until October 31st as well. And I don't think we've received any applications at this point. So again, we'll be reposting that. So if you know of a nurse practicing in Clark County that might be interested, we'd love to have them join us. So those are two positions that are still open. And I think that's it for memberships update. Roxanne, would you like to talk about the Board of Health retreat, please? You're on mute.
I unmuted and then remuted. That's how my day has gone for sure. All right. So we have our next meeting for our planning group, which is on November 6th. And we will be sending out a poll to all of FAC membership and Board of Health members after the election. So we do have two new council members that will be seated. And so we're going to wait until after the election to send the poll out. But we will be identifying some specific dates that work best for everybody for the retreat date. And that'll be the retreat is going to be sometime we're planning in probably late first quarter of 2025. We'll just see where everybody lands as far as their availability, but that's kind of the timing that we're looking at. Our next planning meeting, as I mentioned, is on November 6th. And then from that meeting, the intent would be to have the agenda fairly well dialed in about what we're going to be to be working on. I think the team had already agreed that we wanted to have it be and certainly an offsite somewhere. So we have some work to do around the location of where this is going to be. It's likely going to be about 6 hours, so basically all day, but we'll have a lunch break and all that stuff. And so we're working on that agenda right now based on the feedback that we got. So I'll give you another update at our next meeting and let you know how our meetings are going. But stay tuned, sometime past November 6th for that poll to see your availability for first quarter next year.
Well, that's exciting. And I liked seeing the movement for this. We've talked about it for quite a few months. So
Yeah.
I'm excited to see that come to fruition next year.
Can I give one other really super quick update about a project we're working on at Public Health? Is that okay?
You bet.
Okay, so we've been working on bringing in a racial equity consultant to help us with looking at our internal policies and procedures, as well as how we're doing our work in the community. So there's sort of an internal and an external assessment that's going to be happening. And the consultant will be helping us to build a framework and metrics around our racial equity work. And this really underlies our strategic plan, our 5-year strategic plan. So this work is really foundational to, and building metrics around our racial equity work is foundational to everything we're doing with regard to our strategic plan. So that con we got a little bit delayed. We had 15 respondents to our RFP that was published last June. And all of them were great in many ways. Each brought very different sort of perspectives on how to do this work. And so our team actually, it was a multidisciplinary team that actually evaluated these groups of the respondents and their responses to the RFP. We narrowed it down to two candidates. We did some interviews with those final two candidates, and we're at the process now where we have an apparent awardee. However, we're finishing up on a few last minute things right now before I can publicly announce it. But we do expect a contract hopefully will be in place by mid-November. So we are a little bit late in this. I was hoping to have the contract in place, you know, be more towards the beginning of this month, late in September. So it's just been a lot longer of a process. Part of that is due to the number of respondents that we got. So that was really exciting that we had so many qualified folks. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're at, and we'll be able to do that public announcement here fairly soon.
That's exciting. Thank you, Roxanne. I see that Andrea joined us, and I want to welcome you. And we'll go back to the beginning, Andrea, and include you in our icebreaker as to what is your favorite Halloween costume that you or some family member wore.
I thought I was going to get out of the icebreaker.
No?
Nope.
I saw you sneak in. I wasn't going to let you get away with it.
Let's see. These icebreakers are fantastic because it hits every single introverted part of my personality. Favorite Halloween costume.
Most memorable. Some people had a most memorable one.
Does anybody remember the kids like flip books where the shapes had names? It was like Mr. So-and-so, like Mr. Happy, Mr. Like it was like shapes, color. Yes. I convinced my parents to like dress me up, I believe, as like the red square character. And I can't remember what the associated feeling was, but that was a really big deal. And there was like spray paint, duct tape and involved. And that's a core memory that counts, right?
So the best duct tape and aluminum foil and...
Now I got to find what those books were. I don't see them around anymore. So, yep.
Well, great. Thanks for sharing. And welcome.
Thank you.
That we're about to the end of the meeting.
Sorry about that, Swimless.
No worries. No worries. This is the time when we ask for FAC members to, if you have any community updates that you want to share with everybody, something going on that you know about. Oh, there's the almond butter and jam. Can you see it in Emily's picture? So cute.
So adorable.
Adorable. Thanks, Emily. Council Marshall.
Yes, thanks. I just thought I'd give you a little update. I chair the ECHO, which is the Ending Community Homelessness Organization. Dr. Melnick serves on that as well. We have been kind of reorganizing ourselves. It's a collaborative council, largely elected officials to coordinate response to homelessness and service providers as well. One thing that the group has been struggling with since last January is severe weather and when to call severe weather events. A lot has fallen to the Council for the Homeless to respond. I think resources are definitely strapped with CRESA, the county, and Council for the Homeless because the response is largely nonprofits and relies on volunteers. And what with the increasing number of severe weather events, that's just heat and cold and now smoke as well, the system is really getting taxed. So I just wanted you to be aware of that. I think we've been doing a good job getting the right people to talk to each other so that people understand who's doing what and there's better coordination. But fundamentally, there needs to be more resources in the system. And I don't know what... I remember those books too. I don't know what data is collected with public health, but if there could be some, I think, focus on, you know, what are all the reasons people are becoming homeless. I know there's some people just think it's opioid addiction. I think it's a much more complicated picture, but I just raise that if there's any resources, or if you would like to come to an ECHO meeting, anyone, and talk about what kind of information you have on hand about the homeless population and their health concerns. And you know, there's more people that are dying on the streets, and what is the data around that? I think that can all better inform how we serve that population. So I just wanted to alert you to that, because we're struggling with, you know, where best to put our limited resources. So that's just what I wanted to share.
Thanks for sharing that. Does anybody else have anything to share?
I don't know if this is an appropriate one for this or not. It's something that the YWCA is doing in November 9th and 10th. We're having a BIPOC Youth Summit for 13 to 19-year-olds. So thinking of the supportive and connections for young people. And it's 2 days with workshops and just socializing connection stuff. So,
yes, this is a very appropriate place to share. We can spread the word.
Hey, Lori, when is that? Summit?
It's November 9th and 10th, from 10 to 4:30. And if I were really sharp, I would have, I'm going to drop in the chat Sam Garrison's contact. If I were really quick, I'd be able to drop the flyer in there, but I'm just going to put Sam's.
You can always send the flyer to me as well, or Roxanne, if that would be easier.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
I also wanted to just share that Rob had to jump off really quickly today from our meeting. But he mentioned that tonight is the last meeting of the Battleground University. And he mentioned this at our last meeting. And what that is it's a community program that provides training about how city government works. And so I'm going to ask him if he can, after tonight's meeting, maybe give us an update that we can include in the notes as well to see how that went. And maybe he can talk about it next time, too.
Good. Any other announcements or things you want to share or questions you have? All right, well, we're just about to the end of our agenda. The last thing is our next meeting is scheduled for November 26th, which is the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And typically we've kind of adjusted that meeting because we try to go dark in December, because that's a busy holiday time as well. And so I kind of want to do a little survey, and you can either raise your hand using your little symbol or just raise your hand in your video, as to if you would prefer to meet on December 3rd, which is the next Tuesday, instead of the November 26th meeting. So if you'd prefer to meet on December 3rd, if you'll raise your hand. And Mallory, are you trying to count too?
This is Paul. I'm flexible for anything.
And this is Christine. I'm flexible too. I'll be here. So whatever works best for everyone.
Okay.
It's around like half.
50-50.
Just want to make sure, Council Marshall, that's not the evening of the Clark County Council meeting, is it?
I think the first Tuesday is usually a morning.
Oh, good. Okay.
But this would be on a Tuesday evening. Well, it'll be a long day for me.
That's that's the budget hearing for non-electeds. This is during the day.
Okay. So it doesn't interfere with the council meeting. Great.
Right. Thanks.
Okay. Well, The executive committee, I guess I'll take that under advisement and we'll let you know as soon as possible if we'll keep it on the 26th or if we'll move it to the 3rd.
It looks like you had a lot of votes for moving it, if that's what people's hands up were.
I think so.
We had, I counted, and Mallory, I may have miscounted, but it looked like 11, 10
Yeah,
or 11, 11, is
that's
that
what I
what you had?
received too.
Okay, there we go, 11.
Yeah, and then we had several and that said either one works. So it looks like we're leaning to possibly moving that till December 3rd. We'll let you know in for sure if we're going to move that. All righty. Anything else for the good of the cause?
Sandy, I also think that meeting is intended to be virtual as well, not in person. So,
Yes, that will be virtual. Our in-person one will be in January
yes.
or the first meeting of the 2025 year. Thanks for reminding me to say that. All right. If there's nothing else that we need to discuss, we can adjourn 30 minutes early tonight. And have a great evening and a nice fall season, and we'll see you probably in December.
Thanks a
Thank
lot,
you,
everyone.
everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Happy
Bye,
Halloween.
everybody.
Happy Halloween.
Bye.
Get those costumes.